101.3 WVKR Independent Radio Poughkeepsie, New York. We're just going to stop that now, and we're going to pick it back up after the conversation that we have. That was what we just heard, Millennial Territory Orchestra, Court of Relativity, Community Music, Volume 1, Tinctures in Time. Stay tuned for more of that music. But first, I'm so thrilled to say that we have Stephen online. Let me get him. Stephen?
Yes, what's happening, Rita? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing wonderful. So nice to hear your voice. I was so excited for the show today. So always love talking with you. Let me do a brief introduction, if I may, Maestro.
Okay.
All right. So I'll start off by saying to the listeners, Downbeat Critics poll Rising Star Arranger for 3 consecutive years, Grammy awardee, trumpeter, composer, arranger, and bandleader Stephen Bernstein has immersed himself in a wide array of music with bands such as the Lounge Lizards, Sex Mob, Millennial Territory Orchestra, Spanish Fly, Butler Bernstein, Hot 9, just to name a few. Stephen has composed works for film, theater, and dance, in addition to doing arrangements for a diverse list of musicians, including Lou Reed, Lee Scratch Perry, Alan Toussaint, Linda Ronstadt, Rufus Wainwright, Bill Frisell, just to name a few. His band, Sex Mob, will be releasing a new album this spring titled Corbett vs. Dempsey, which we will be premiering a track from after this conversation. And with that, a warm welcome back to Local Motion, Maestro Stephen Bernstein.
Thank you, Rita. How you doing?
That's my name for you. So the last time I saw you, we were downstairs at the Capitol Theater because you kicked some ass with Hot Tuna.
Yeah, before I say that, I gotta say the new Sex Mob record is called The Hard Way, and it's coming out on Corbett vs. Dempsey.
Oh, what do I know? Okay.
Well, now you know that.
Now I know that. You've just coming out. Oh, that's a label. Okay. Okay. Wonderful.
Label,
great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. All right. So, yes, I saw you at the basement of the Capitol at the end of last year, which was an amazing year. And kind of capped off a crazy wild year by playing a bunch of nights with Hot Tuna.
Oh, man. And you just sounded so good with them. It was just you. It wasn't like a whole horn section. It was you. And
It was me improvising with them. And it was amazing because I got to do some things I haven't really done in decades, which is, you know, use a wah-wah pedal with electric trumpet because... It's something I used to do in the early 80s and did it on maybe a project a friend had, Bobby Previtt's project. I think I played some electric trumpet with Slide like, I don't know, 20 years ago. But it's something I love, but there's just not a lot of opportunity to do it. And when I was, the whole thing with playing with Tuna, they were just play. They were like, don't worry about like getting in the way, just play whatever you hear. And I was listening to the music and I'm from the Bay Area.
Right.
And I was listening to that music and listening to all that great wah-wah stuff. And I said, oh, this would be a great opportunity to just get in there and have some fun with that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It sounded so good. I've seen Tuna so many times I can't even count. But you really just added a whole nother perspective to that music. And it just, I can't say enough. It was really cool. And then, of course, we took that good picture of you and Yorma that's gone kind of viral online. So.
Oh, awesome. Well, the thing is about playing with Tuna, you know, they've never had a horn player play.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they've ever really had a even though I kind of always careful about calling myself a jazz musician, because in a sense, I am a jazz musician. And that's the world I come from, you know. I grew up in the world of Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and Don Cherry and Lester Bowie. So that's kind of my perspective on things. And I don't know if they've ever had someone play with a band who, like, that's their perspective.
Yeah, no, it was really cool to see that. I hope that happens again at some point with them. I really do. So that would be really cool. Now, let's step back a little bit in time, if we could, Maestro.
Let's do it.
As you say, you are from the left coast. You were born in Berkeley, California.
No, I wasn't born. I was raised in Berkeley.
Where were you born?
Well, my parents were moving around when I was a kid, so I was born in D.C. My dad was completing his medical degree at Howard University.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then we lived in Chicago for a year when he was doing his internship, and then we moved to Boston, and then we moved to Berkeley in summer of '68. So just as, like, Berkeley just as like the hippie movement is like taking over, that we moved to this place and it was wild. So I grew up like literally, I always tell people, I'm a child of the revolution. Right. You know, we grew up in the midst of all that amazing stuff.
Right, but you were little when all that was happening. Like what?
Yeah.
Elementary school.
Yeah. But like I said, you know, I went to Black Panther summer camp. I mean, how many people get to say they did that, you know?
What?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't called Black Panther summer camp. I like to call it that. But it was a summer program, a free kids program that the Panthers were running. And my folks didn't have much money back then. And my mom saw this sign for free youth summer program. So she dropped me off.
Oh, my God. Musical family. I know your dad was a doc. But how did you get into it? Did they expose you? Did they listen to
us? Oh, yeah. They always had liked records. My parents, they're from that generation. You know, there was a certain generation in the East Coast that really grew up. I mean, I think maybe my dad's older cousin, Joel, was really into jazz. But, you know, they used to sit there. My dad grew up in Bayonne on the radio, you know, when it's a... I guess it'd be the late 40s, and you listen to live broadcasts from Birdland. And, you know, went and saw Count Basie at Birdland. He tells a story that they were advertising Bermuda shorts, and it was the middle of the winter. And they said, look, if anyone shows up in Birdland in Bermuda shorts, you get in for free. So they put on Bermuda shorts and got on the bus in Bayonne and got to Birdland for free. You know, and that generation, my dad's generation, you know, musicians, the same way sports athletes are American celebrities now, musicians were American celebrities because people listened to the radio. And they would announce, and you know, Duke Ellington would say, hey, we're going to feature Rex Stewart on this next piece. So everyone listens to the radio. There's no TV, right?
Right.
So everyone listens to the radio, and they're going, okay, Rex Stewart, I know that name. And then they listen to Count Basie, you know, we'd like to feature, you know, Jimmy Rushing singing. And they say, oh, okay, Jimmy Rushing. So musicians really were, you know, very big celebrities in American culture because what was it? It was radio.
Right, you know? Where everybody was listening to radio. Absolutely, you're right, because TV didn't come till the 50s. So, yeah,
right.
Now, what was your first instrument?
A trumpet. I'm just a trumpet man from the beginning, from fourth grade, yeah.
Why trumpet?
Louis Armstrong. And I believe, check this out, I tell a story I've always told. I said I used to see Louis Armstrong on TV when I got home from school, and I thought he was the coolest guy. And when we, and in fourth grade, they had an assembly and they showed a slideshow of all the instruments and said you could pick an instrument. So I said, well, I'm gonna pick trumpet. But I'm telling you something, like, I don't know, sometimes we invent histories for ourselves, but I swear to God, I don't know if you've seen the new Louis Armstrong documentary that Sasha Jenkins did. I believe it's on Amazon Prime. It's called Black and Blue. And it's about Louis Armstrong, not as much as, yes, as a musician, but as like a social activist, basically, as a person who kind of really, you know, this black Afro-American, black American, whatever you want to call him, who became the most famous person in the world.
Right.
At a time when, you know, black people couldn't even get food at a restaurant or use a bathroom, and he became the most famous person in the world.
Right.
And it's an amazing story about how he navigated his life, you know, his public persona and how he felt about the world. And it shows this incredible interview with Dick Cavett, and he's telling this story, and it just how he would throw a positive spin on things. And he talks about when he went back to New Orleans and the announcer didn't want to announce him. Mm. And instead of him, because he said, I'm not going to announce, and you can imagine the word he put in there.
Right.
So instead of being upset, I mean, obviously he's upset about it because it's horrifying, but his thing was like, he said, okay, I'm going to announce myself. And he goes, and then from then on, he goes, that guy was fired. I had a job, you know? And you know, he basically turned the tides on it, and just through his immense positive attitude just said, okay, this guy's a racist idiot, and guess what, I'm not even going to let that affect my genius and my ability to get my job done and to give people the greatest music they've ever heard in their life. And I swear to God, that's the interview I saw when I was a kid that made me love Louis Armstrong.
Wow. Have you been to the house in Queens?
Oh yeah. The guy the guys who run it, there's a different guy running it now, but they, you know, they're friends and fans of mine. So the guy running at the time called me up and said, hey man, he goes, you should come. I'll give you a private tour. Come whatever day you want. And I get there and he says, well, he says, you want to go into Louis' garden and then enjoy what Louis would have done before he enjoyed himself? And I said, of course. So I got to hang out in Louis' garden and
open
up in honor of Louis.
Oh.
And then basically a guy gave me a tour and said, hey, you know, I had my horn with me. He said, you know, spend the next couple hours here just soaking up the vibes and hanging out. So, you know, I played trumpet in Louis Armstrong's house and just soaked up the vibes. And I mean, it's really, I always tell people, like, you know, even though I make so much of my living as a rock and roll trumpet player, I play everything as Louis Armstrong. I mean, I'm not coming from, like, rock and roll trumpet playing. I'm coming from the original rock and roll trumpet playing, which is Louis Armstrong. Everything I play, whether I'm in that kind of way of playing, like, I mean, it's very clear the stuff with Hot Tuna because they play those ragtime tunes.
Right.
But even when I'm playing with someone like Little Feat, I'm using that phrasing that Louis Armstrong kind of brought into the world.
That's
the phrasing I'm using. I always tell people, they don't know they're hearing Louis Armstrong, but they're hearing Louis Armstrong.
They hear me
play with Little Feat. They're hearing Louis Armstrong.
So I got to tell you that I share a birthday with Louis Armstrong.
And
For my birthday this year, that's what I want to do is go to his house in Queens.
It's an amazing thing to do.
NOLA for Thanksgiving, and I went to the Jazz Museum down there. There's one thing from Armstrong there. All his stuff is in Queens. All his memorabilia is in Queens.
Yeah.
I was expecting a whole bunch of stuff in New Orleans Jazz Museum. There was one handkerchief that said Satchmo on it. That's all there was of Louis Armstrong. So
that's so funny.
And
how great is that museum, though?
Oh, it's wonderful.
Man, I love that museum.
Oh my God, a great museum! Such a great museum. But this year, I'm spending my birthday with my birthday buddy Louis Armstrong.
All right,
so,
on.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So, in music, I understand that you had a teacher that was like a huge influence. Talk to me about Phil Hardiman.
So Phil Hardiman was a guy, he passed away and years kind of jumbled together, but I'd say about 94. He was pretty young at the time, and him and a guy named Dick Whittington, who was a professional piano player who had actually made some records, and a fairly famous person in the jazz world named Dr. Herb Wong, who was a DJ and a producer and a concert producer and a record producer. And at the time, he was working for the school district, and they had an idea to start a jazz program for kids, for, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth graders. I don't know. To be honest, I don't know how. There is a story somewhere about how this first happened. Again, this is like right at the beginning of civil rights. It's the beginning of integration, because I think the schools were just integrated in 67.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started there in schools were integrated in 67. So the jazz program might not have, actually, I was only in second, I was in third grade in 68. So I think it was the next year, 69 or 70, they started this program. And basically, Phil Hardiman wrote these charts for people who had just started playing music, the beginning of band, to have a jazz band. And one of the things that happened, there were two kids there who were, you can call them phenomenons, you can call them child prodigies, you can call them geniuses, whatever you want, Peter Applebaum and Rodney Franklin. And Peter was like playing drums in like a little third or second grade band. I don't know. Rodney was a year or two older. And they could both of them could play a bunch of instruments. They could play drums, piano. Rodney played bass. Peter played saxophone. And they were kind of like, they built these programs around these super talented young kids. And Hardiman would write these charts that were easy enough that kids could play them. And he wrote his own tunes, but he also did Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. And I believe we did I Wish I Would Know How It Feels to Be Free. One of those songs like that, because there were always kids in the school who were good singers.
Mm-hmm.
Usually there were kids whose parents were professional singers. There's a lot of gospel singers in Oakland, you know, that's where the Oh Happy Day, Edwin Hawkins singers are from Oakland, so that was a very big gospel situation in Oakland. And and what Mr. Harmon did was he got us to improvise it, like in fourth grade. And he gave me what we called the three notes, the ba, ba, ba. And he'd play them, and the kids would repeat them, ba, ba, ba. And then he'd go, bee, dee, da. And all the little kids would go, bee, dee, da.
Wow.
He'd go, da, 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 da. He'd go, da, da, dee, dee, da. Just like that. And then he'd do that for a couple of days, a couple of classes, and then say, okay, now you make up your own song with those three notes.
Wow, what a way to teach. What a way to teach.
Yeah. So then it's like, okay, I found out all the little things I can do with three notes, and you'd get up there, and at the assemblies for the kids, you'd all get, everyone would take a solo.
Wow.
Using those three notes.
Right.
And those are still the three notes that I use. I want to call my friends and they go, they've been playing the same thing we've been playing since we're in fifth grade. I'm like, yeah, I know.
Amazing. Amazing. And I think it's so cool. Peter Apfelbaum, you play, he's your buddy, he's your friend, and you guys have known each other since then.
We've been playing together almost 50 years now. It's crazy.
Wow.
And I think the one time that Peter subbed in the Ramble Band, then Larry Campbell just turned around like, who is this guy? Because, you know, Peter's a preacher when he plays. He's a real, you know, he's a natural, I mean, you know, those guys, he just plays music. He can play, and he plays in a very natural, humanistic way, I remember. And Larry didn't know him. Larry just, Peter started playing some solo, and Larry turned around, his eyes were like, who is this guy?
I love when Larry does that. That is a really cool thing. I could just see him do that also.
Right.
Really, really cool.
Yeah.
Now, I understand you actually found Woodstock because you came at the age of 15. You spent part of your summer in Woodstock at the Creative Music Studio.
I went to me and Peter together in 1977. So I'm October birthday. Peter's August birthday. So, yeah, I mean, I was born in 61. So I would have been turning 16 that year, because 77, but I was still 15, and Peter was still 16, right? Yeah.
And
we went there, we spent the summer up there, and it was at Oler's Mountain Lodge, which was in, what do you call it? It's before you get to Woodstock.
West Hurley?
You know where? Yeah, West Hurley, exactly.
Yep.
You know where the used to be, like the cake shop or the place with the windmill on it.
Yes, yes, yes.
So if you turned there, and went down the road like 3/4 mile, that's where it was.
Yeah, and boy, those were the days, right? Ornette Coleman and Carl Berger.
Yeah. Well, Ornette wasn't there when I was there, but I mean, George Russell came up, Dollar Brand. Sonny Murray, Carla Bley, and Michael Mantler, who were both living in town. John Cage came up and did a concert. And
did you realize who these guys were when you were?
I started because of Peter had and Mr. Hardiman. Well, Mr. Hardiman had very good taste in music, and he made sure we listened to good music. And Peter, for whatever reason, maybe because he, you know, another kind of guy, he was really attracted to the kind of modern music. So we'd be listening to Art Ensemble Chicago and Ross on Roland Kirk and Don Cherry and Sam Rivers and all this stuff. And we're like kids. I mean, I remember one time, and I guess I was in seventh grade and Peter was in eighth grade. Unless I was in eighth and Peter was in ninth. We heard the story that these kind of young local avant-garde jazz musicians were going to be playing right by the junior high on Telegraph Avenue. So we went down there. And it means, like, you know, I was like either 12 or 13, you know, and we go down. And of course, you know, everyone's in their 20s. And we're like these two little white kids. Like, you know.
They're like, who are these kids?
And it's funny. It ended up being David Murray and Butch Morris. And the late, I don't know if you know who Butch was. He was an amazing person who did this, what they call, he had created this thing called conduction that a lot of people have carried on. He was a cornet and trumpet player. And I used to always tell this joke about, you know, tell this story around Butch. I was 12 or 13 when I met him. And Butch was, he goes, really? Because I always thought you were 9. You know? But the funny thing was that Butch gave me my first real gig, my first record date in New York, which is how I met all the East Village people, which is how I met, you know, like everybody from, you know, from like Zorn and Elliot Sharp and Bobby Previtt and all these kind of well-known East Village people I met because of this first record date that that Butch put me on, and I first met Butch when I was either 12 or 13
wow.
years old.
Wow, wow. And also something happened to you, to get back to Woodstock real quick. You went into a music store there.
Oh, yeah.
And you
I bought a slide trumpet. There was these slide trumpets on the wall, these little cheap slide trumpets, and they were $25. Right. It was a guitar shop. I mean, in my mind, it was like straight down Tinker Street a little bit, you know, like downtown Woodstock, maybe a little past downtown Woodstock. And I remember there being like a bridge, almost like a wooden bridge over the river. And there was a little music store on the other side, but mainly a guitar shop. And someone wanted to go there. We walked in. These were on the wall. And I bought one and Peter bought one. And I ended up, you know, keeping it and playing it. And I used to play it in my bands. And, you know, one day my friend, the great trumpet player and composer Dave Douglas, said to me, I used to play a couple songs in every band. He said, man, why don't you, because I used to play it very naturally. I could just play some stuff on it. But he said to me, why don't you practice that thing? And I thought, that's a good idea. So I started practicing it. And then I said, well, why don't I put together a band where I only play the slide trumpet? So it'll force me to figure out how to play this instrument. I go, I'm a star band. I'm not even going to have a trumpet. I'm just going to have a slide trumpet. And that was in the kind of glory days of the Knitting Factory. And I guess this is 97. And that's when we started Six Month. I had a gig every Thursday night from 11 to 2. And I started this band where I was only going to play a slide trumpet.
Wow. Isn't that something? It changed your life buying that instrument.
Yeah, man. It sure did. Yeah. Well, it changed my life buying it and sticking with it. Because the reality is, a lot of people bought them. And people, trumpet players my age, a little older, almost everyone bought one of these instruments for $25, $75. But most of them played it and then just threw it in the closet.
Right. You still have that same one that you bought in
1970? Oh, yeah. Oh,
man.
Yeah, dude.
That's so sweet. Yeah. And then you moved to New York in 78. And
79.
And you went to Columbia, but then graduated NYU 84, correct?
Right. Because I went to Columbia for a couple of years, and I realized, and I started hanging out. And I was hanging out from the day I got to Columbia, because I'd already been to New York. I knew my way around. And I went down to the East Village like the very first weekend, you know, and, you know, I was wandering around and going to places to hear music. And I used to go to Squat Theater on 23rd every weekend to hear either Sun Ra or Defunct. And, you know, I was really hanging. And it was, at first I did okay in Columbia because I was, you know, young and smart and inspired. And then pretty soon it got to be like, yeah, I don't know if this is really going to work out. I told my dad, I was like, you're wasting your money because I'm not really dealing with these classes, you know.
What were you studying? What were you studying?
Well, Columbia has what's called a core curriculum, which was fantastic to take. You could take all these classes that you need to take to graduate. And, you know, what people don't like to teach anymore because it's European history. It's like whatever, a lot of white dudes and males. I mean, they're all dead. You can't really get mad at them. But, you know, but I got to read Homer and Dante and Plato, and growing up in Berkeley, we didn't read any of that stuff. Like, I only had, you know, I never had American history. I had African history and Black history growing up. So it was kind of cool for me to get all this kind of classic European, you know, the kind of the foundation. I mean, I got to say, reading The Cave, Allegory of the Cave by, you know, by Plato, that changed my life. You know, and then you read all those kind of, you know, Jude the Obscure, St. Thomas of Aquinas, and you know, it's kind of Beowulf, and I guess I read Beowulf in high school, but it's nice. It's good to, I enjoyed reading all that stuff. I think I got a lot out of it.
Yeah.
But then when it came time to get a major, I said, you know, this is not for me. I want to figure out a way to do music. So,
what was your major at NYU?
Oh, then they had a music. That's what happened. They had a music. What happened was I left school. I got a day job, you know, just a couple of days a week. I worked at Barney Greengrass's Sturgeon King, which is a tremendous place to work. Legendary New York Jewish deli and fish deli, smoked fish, and was playing gigs. Because that was that summer, the summer after I left Columbia, was when I did that record that Butch got me on. That's when I met all these Village people. So then people were like, oh, I started getting in people's bands. Because in these Village, everyone had a band. I got in this band, Foreign Legion, that Paul Shapiro had, and, you know, I started like, you know, we were playing down at the Pyramid Club and, you know, Mud Club and Danceteria. I'm starting to do all that stuff. But I was working a day job. So I was going out every night. I even played at the Ritz with like some band. Like, I'm trying to remember now. Like, I remember I got one gig. It felt like, oh, this is big time. You know, some, you know, new wave band that was pretty big at the time. But then it was getting hard to, like, you know, be out all night and go to work. And NYU had just started a jazz program. It just started. And I said, oh, check this out, a jazz program in New York City. So I ended up getting a jazz degree. And I met this, my trumpet teacher there was another guy who changed my life, Jimmy Maxwell. So my trumpet teacher there was a guy who was kind of one of the older trumpet players in New York at the time. And he had come, he had joined Benny Goodman's band to replace Harry James, like at the peak of the Benny Goodman band, sat next to Cootie Williams, who was Duke Ellington's legendary soloist, who had left Duke Ellington to join Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman was a big, I always tell people, my trumpet teacher replacing, he, I don't think he plays, actually, to be honest, I don't know if he replaced Ziggy Elman or Harry James, but he replaced one of Benny's star trumpet players. I said it was like when David Grohl joined Nirvana. Mm-hmm. That's what it was like. Mm-hmm. Because everyone in America, people don't kind of, who don't really know about American cultural history, don't understand, like, Benny Goodman was like Nirvana at the time. It was loud and raucous, and it was a thing that young people liked, you know? And so he was this really legendary guy, and he had gotten off the road and joined NBC staff, first on the radio. He did NBC radio, and then once he started NBC TV, he was staff on TV. So he did, like, the Perry Como show. He did the original Steve Allen show, the original Tonight Show. Wow. He was this, and made all these records. He played the theme to The Godfather on the movie. Yeah, but he came up because of his age and being in Benny's band. He was there. Like, Dizzy looked up to him. Miles knew him. Like, everyone knew him because he was this guy that was playing lead in Benny Goodman's band as a young guy. And, you know, he knew everyone. He knew Coleman Hawkins and he knew Count Basie and he knew, you know, he knew everyone. You know? Duke Ellington even tried to give him a job in like the 60s. And he said, Duke, he said, you're my hero, but I have a family. I don't think you can afford to pay me what NBC pays me.
Right. Wow. Wow. What a mentor to have. Did you see Miles when you were in New York at that age?
Well, Miles came out of retirement and I saw, I think it was his first show, which was summer of 83, which was, like Schaefer Presents or something like that. Like, it was a show on the pier, like, you know, the West Side Highway and maybe 54th Street. There was a pier. They did concerts. So I saw that one. Miles used to hang out, though, at this after-hours place in the Upper West Side, but I was always too scared to go there. It was a pretty heavy scene. I had friends from the Upper West Side, like, you know, if you go to this bar late at night, you never know, man. There's, you know, Miles may show up, you know,
right,
in the early 80s.
Right.
So I never got to really interact with him, you know, and I saw him play, you know, Billy Hall, you know, I got to see him play. I think that might have been the only time, the Alice Tully Hall show and the outdoor show.
Yeah,
might have been the only.
Hey,
time
that's cool. At least you saw him, so that's a really cool thing. Another big, I think, mentor in your life. Talk a little bit about Hal Wilner.
Wilner. Yeah. So Hal Wilner goes back to summer of 1981.
Sorry, my phone just dropped. That's okay. I hear you in the background, but yep, you'll get us. Yep, you're back.
You're back on, right?
Yes, yes.
So in summer 81, I go to my friend's house, and Dad was a jazz musician and a jazz fan. He says, hey, Stephen, dig this, man. You're going to dig this record. It's far out. In fact, I just have the record out. We're going to do a concert celebrating this record. There's a record called M Accord Nina Rota by a guy named Hal Wilner. Like, wow, this is interesting. And, you know, Nina Rota was the guy who wrote all the music for the Fellini films. And I look who's on the record. It's Jackie Byard, Carla Bley, Mulhall Richard Abrams, Sharon Freeman, the great arranger. David Amram.
Wow.
And then there's a couple names. But then the funny thing that really got people's we're like, wow, what is this? Was he had Chris Stein and Debbie Harry from Blondie.
Wow.
Now, you have to understand, in 1981, Blondie was one of the biggest acts on the planet.
Yeah.
Not just New York. They were already having worldwide hits, and they're on this record next to Muhal Richard Abrams and Carla Bley and Jackie Byron and Steve Lacy playing solo. And not only that, Hal was such a visionary. It's Bill Frisell's first record date, real record date, and it's also, I believe, the first record date that Wynton and Branford Marsalis did in New York, because their father's friend, William Fisher, who was an arranger, I believe that's how they got on the date. And it's Ron Carter's playing bass on it, Kenny Barron's playing drums, and 18 or 19-year-old Wynton and Branford are on it.
Man.
And how was this? And so it's like one of those things, like you talk about opening the doors of perception. Like growing up in Berkeley, I saw that there was a very psychedelic vision of the world. Like everything can kind of exist together. And I came to New York and I saw that people were trying to do this by mixing like avant-garde music and funk music and these things. And then Hal came and he's like, no, you can just pull every single spice out of the spice rack you want and just put it and cook a meal with everything. And I realized, wow, that's what I want to do. That's what I've been looking for. Like, wait, you can do Fellini's film music and have the great Jackie Byard and then have like Colorado, you know, all, and William Fisher, who wrote the arrangement that has Wynton and Branford on it, was one of Atlantic's main arrangers. He did all the arrangements for, you know, Roberta Flack and those kind of records. So Hal was like, now we take that for granted, but in 1981, nobody was doing anything like that.
Right.
And I had a band called Spanish Fly, and it turned out Hal, I always wanted to meet him, but it was very hard to kind of find him. He was a mysterious guy. He was also in a position of power. Like he was making records for, are they Warner Brothers? Those big, they had big, these giant, but after this record, he got this, he called them concept records. And it was the concept record. And he kind of invented the idea of the concept record. So then I'm not sure the exact order, but there was a concept record that this was a concept record on Nina Rota. And then there was, Thelonious Monk, then there was Kurt Vile, then there was Disney movies. And you have a record, and one song would be Ringo Starr, and the next song would be Sun Ra. You know, he was just, and eventually, he did a TV show called Night Music, and I did that when I was about 29, and he came up to me. He was the music producer on it. I was doing it with Karen Mantler, who's Carla Bley's daughter, and Carla Bley, and Bootsy, and Alan Toussaint. And Hal comes up to me and says, hey, man, I'm Hal Willmer. I'm like, oh, wow, you're Hal, really great to meet you. He says, I love your band Spanish Fly. I'm like, wow. And he said, yeah, if I could ever do anything for you, like, you know, here's my number, give me a call.
Oh, my God.
And he produced our first record. And I, you know, I'm 30 years old, and that just kind of started this relationship, and we ended up, he ended up first being a guy like I worked for all the time. I mean, I did, you know, including like the last thing, big thing we did together was U2 Live at the Apollo with the Sex Mob Orchestra horns and the Sun Ra Orchestra horns.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Wow. And there's a live CD of it, but it's only available for people who are in the U2 fan club. So it wasn't a commercially available CD, but yeah, it's out. And it's Sun Ra's, you know, and so I had like an expanded version of the Sex Mob horns, and I had five of the Sun Ra horns.
Oh my God.
And yeah, that's the kind of thing, and that's the kind of call I would get from Hal. That was a Tuesday night call. See, Hal was impossible to get hold of because that's the way he was. But if he called you, you picked up the phone no matter what time it was because you never knew it was.
Man.
One time it was the summer. And the phone rings. It's about 1:30 in the morning on a Tuesday.
And you're wide awake because you're Steven Bernstein.
Yeah, of course I'm wide awake. You know, and I'm, you know, probably like writing a chart and watching TV at the same time. And I'm like, hey, Hal. He's like, oh, what are you doing next Sunday and Monday? I said, man, well, I actually have those nights off. I'm doing I was doing a week with Gina Gershon at Cafe Carlisle. He's like, I think I got it something with U2 and Sun Ra. It's not for sure, but just hold those dates. And I'm like, all right, Hal, let me know, man. That's fantastic. But you know, they say, like, is this gonna happen? Because I'm gonna need to write charts in the next few days. So yeah, we did it, and that's the kind of thing as much as you know, I miss Hal as a friend, but there'll never be another person in the world who's going to call you up at 1:30 in the morning and mumble to you that we may have a gig with Sun Ra and U2 in 4 days.
Oh, my God. What a combination. I couldn't even put them together or think of putting them together. That's why
he was Hal Wilner.
Oh, like man.
And we're actually going to do a concert of this Nina Rota music on his birthday weekend this year at Roulette on April 8th.
Oh, my gosh. And
it's the first time this music has been played live in New York. The record's over 50 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were supposed to do it outdoors at Lincoln Center like 6 years ago. And it wasn't just a rainstorm. It was a crazy electrical storm.
Oh.
And Hal had flown in like some arrangers from Europe. Michael Gibbs, a legendary arranger who was living in Spain at the time. He flew in another arranger, Kane St. John from London, and we had an 18-piece band, and all these people were here, and we didn't get to do the concert. So we are
doing
the concert. We're doing it, and Frizzell's going to be a guest, and I believe Laurie Anderson
is going to
be a guest.
And where is this? Where is this?
At Roulette is a performance space in Brooklyn, in downtown Brooklyn.
Okay.
Called Roulette, and it's going to be April 8th.
All right. People got to go to StephenBernstein.net. There's so much more to talk about, but we only have a few more minutes because I want to play your music. You've also been such a big part of Levon and the Midnight Ramble band, the horn band. Tell me about that briefly, meeting Levon and how you got mixed into that.
Okay. So the funny story is I never listened to rock music when I was a kid. I was like kind of like obstinate, like typical, like snobby teenagers, like, everyone else likes rock. I like jazz. Street guys. Right? Especially living in Berkeley, where like there's rock everywhere. Like, but I used to hang out at this record store. And then, you know, when you're a kid back in those days, hang out at the record store all day, and we opened up, you know, all the used records, and it was run by these hippie guys, you know, hippie jazz guys. But, you know, and I remember opening up this record, said the band, and I'd heard of the band, and I opened up and I see a picture of Howard Johnson and Snooky Young playing. Mm. I'm like, oh man, this looks really cool, man. I want to get this. And I knew, I'd heard of Alan Toussaint. I knew he was a New Orleans guy. So I said, let me get it. And I love that record. Now, I never bought another band record in my life, but I love that record so much. I had it on vinyl. Then I had it on cassette so I could listen to it in my car when my car had a cassette tape. Then I got it on CDs when CDs first came out. And then when they got like the exclusive new version on the CD, I bought that one. Now, at this point, I still have no other band records. I just have like 6 copies of the one record with Snooky Young and Howard Johnson. So I know all these songs like inside out, man. I haven't listened to them. And then Levon starts to kind of, these things start to happen. And he starts to be around. You know, he played on the Norah Jones record. And my bass player, Tony, and from Sex Mob, and Kenny, they loved the band. They started bringing like cassettes of the band records on tour with us. Back then, we used to do van tours. I remember listening. That's when I started to actually listen to the Brown record and Big Pink was in the van with Sex Mob and going, wow, man, what is this? And they're like, oh, these are the first band records. I'm like, whoa. And then Tony, Levon's book had come out, and Tony would be like reading from Levon's book as we're in the van. I'm like, oh, wow, this is really cool. Then Eric starts saying, oh, man, you know, I'm doing these things with Levon. And Tony had even played guitar. My bass player also plays guitar. He had gone up there. He maybe had played bass. He either played some really early Rambles, like really, really at the beginning. And then Eric was saying, oh, man, you know, you should come up. And, you know, I had a young family. We used to get Saturday night was the night when you do weddings and get some real cash in your pocket. And I was like, I can't, you know, they're like, well, you don't really make any money. Cause at the beginning there was no infrastructure at all. And then one day Eric said, you want to come up this next Saturday? I'm like, well, I don't have a wedding. Let's do it. And they, you know, like Brendan, you know, calls me up and he goes, you know, here's some songs that Levon likes. I'm like, okay. Like, he might want to play these songs. None of them are band songs, mind you. So I just like, you know, and maybe I listened to him. And on the way up, I told Eric, I say, one thing I hate is when people don't, horn players, like at weddings, they have to do this. Like they don't quite know the horn part and they're kind of playing it together. It just sounds super cheesy and horrible. And I call it lowest common denominator, you know, because it's nothing. It's not good. It's not like, it's not, it's just, it's like almost. Mm-hmm. I told Eric, I said, look, man, we're doing this. You know, I don't know what I'm getting paid. I'm doing this to play some music. So here's the thing. Don't try to play what I'm playing. Like, right. I don't want you trying to copy me and doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. You just play what you're going to play, and I'm going to play what I'm going to play. And I guarantee you, if you play something good and I play something good, it'll sound really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. I said, don't try to go with me, man. Let me do what I want to be able to improvise.
Right.
Like, I don't want to have to, like, worry with you about you catching up with me. So it sounded like a big band.
Right.
And we didn't even get to meet Levon.
Wow.
We didn't know anything. Like, we showed up. They said, show up early. You know, we might rehearse. We show up early. We don't meet him. They give me some more songs. They give me a little keyboard and some music paper. I scratch out some couple songs they say Levon might want to do. And we're just on stage, like, kind of with Ola Bell improvising. And Levon just walks out.
Wow.
And looks at us and says hi and counts off. Says, let's do something. And he names the song. The funny thing is, one of the songs we played on that night is on this the DVD Live at the Ramble Volume 2. It starts the record. It starts the CD.
Wow.
And Levon didn't even know my name. I had never been introduced to him. But meanwhile, we're playing together like we're old friends.
Right.
And I'd never met him because he was so musical and he was such a... The music came out of him so directly that there was never any question how the music went. He'd just say, he'd name the song and he would play. He'd play this drum fill and look at you, and I would just have to interpret from the drum fill and from his look what he wanted me to do. Does he want me to play like a melody, or does he want me to play a background? Like, you know, and it just worked. And
right.
I always tell people, we improvised the first two and a half, three years with the Ramble Band.
Wow.
We just improvised. We just listened and reacted.
Are you part of the Ramble Band this weekend too?
Yep. And Amy has kind of rebranded it a bit, you know,
sure.
and because it's calling it the Helm Family Midnight Rambles, and it's kind of, she's brought on some these amazing young guys. We've got Connor's playing, and Adam Minkoff, and Zach, and from the old band, it's the Horns and Brian. And Tony Leone's playing drums, and you know, she's like kind of figuring out like what the next thing the Rambles are going to be. And we did a really great New Year's show, really beautiful, you know. So it's kind of like, all right, it's kind of a fresh start for the band a bit, you know.
Right.
And
see what
and
it morphs into.
Hey, it's morphed, and it's kind of cool. It's exciting. It feels like the beginning again.
Right. Yeah, you know, that's really cool.
Yeah.
So, Stephen, we got to talk because I'll have to have you back this summer when Sex Mob is officially released. But talk to me about this track. You have a couple of shows coming up with Sex Mob at the Jazz Festival out in Oregon, right?
Right. We're doing the Portland Jazz Festival. We're going to just booked a few gigs around there. It's just a quick, I call it a micro tour.
Mm-hmm.
Pacific West. We're just going to do Seattle, Eugene, and Portland. And this is a new record. That we actually started this record before the pandemic. And my friend, the great producer, Scott Harding, Scotty Hard, and I have been, he produced the first four or five Sex Mob records and the first four or five MMW records. And he works with a lot of different bands. He also extensively works with, you know, Prince Paul, De La Soul, RZA, the Wu-Tang people. He's one of the few people that really does hip hop and improvised music, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we've been talking for years about doing a project. And we did a project which is really really him and Sex Mob. Like, he started, what he did was he would send me loops and beats, and one piece was even a totally through composed 8-minute electronic piece he had kind of come up with. And I wrote compositions for the band to go on top of them. So the band recorded, and without acoustic drums, with Kenny playing electric drums, which he plays a lot. Then we listened. Then he added acoustic drums to a bunch of songs. And then he just did his, and he added some guitar. Tony and Brigham both play guitar. And after that, he just starts working with the songs. And he spent, it was during the pandemic, so he just spent a couple years. There wasn't any hurry.
Right.
So he spent a couple years. He had a Medeski on a couple tunes. One of the tunes you're going to hear is with Medeski. He had Vijay Iyer, you know, like our friend.
And the track that you sent me that we're about to listen to, Banachek?
Banachek, yeah, is with Medeski.
Perfect. Perfect. Any Sex Mob dates on the East Coast yet?
We're gonna play at the Stone on March. Actually, we're playing February 14th. We have a Valentine's Day gig at New Blue, February 14th.
Oh, perfect.
With our friend Sasha Dobson, and we always play songs of love, so we don't have to change our repertoire. And then we're gonna play March 24th at the Stone. I'm doing four nights at the Stone, a different project every night in March. And then in May we'll do a record release of some sort. But I can't talk about it yet, but I think there is a very exciting, amazing Sex Mob backing up a very well-known artist this summer in Europe and probably the States too. But I can't really talk about it yet.
Oh.
It's cool enough that everyone's going to know about it when it happens.
Oh, man. Steven, I'm so happy for you. I can't wait to hear this whole new release. I'm honored that you're sending the track. My show's up in 5 minutes, so I'm gonna play that track. And really, thank you. I'm honored to able to play that for the listeners and all of that. StevenBernstein.net. Dude, you got to write a book.
That's what everybody says to me.
Yeah.
I guess I will.
You got to write a book. Right. So listen, I loved seeing you with MTO at Birdland, again, at the Falcon. Everything you put together, you're a master of your craft. Thank you for making the music that you do, man. Just keep doing what you're doing. Huge fan.
Thank you for the support. You know, musicians couldn't do it without people like you. It's all one big community, and people like you are just so important to the community. That spread, that love all kinds of good music, no matter what the style is.
Exactly.
So thank you for being an important part of our
community. Absolutely. Steven, I will see you soon. I'm going to give you a big hug. Maestro, it's an honor to know you, to hear your music. Keep spreading the love. Much love to you. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Rita.
Yep,
bye.
Thank you. Bye. 91.3 WVKR. I love that man. Steven Bernstein. I'll be uploading this interview tonight on YouTube, Local Motion on 91.3 WVKR. If you'd subscribe to the YouTube channel, as well as giving a follow and a like on the Facebook page by the same name, we are going to do the world premiere right now of the new Sex Mob song, Banachek, off the upcoming album called The Hard Way. And I'm going to get off air now so we can listen to it just about in its entirety. I'll return next Wednesday with Rhett Miller, first-time guest, 2 weeks with Ben Swearin, and in 3 weeks, Larry and Teresa. Let's keep it tuned. Let's take a listen to Sex Mob. Again, StevenBernstein.net. You can follow him on socials. He's a master of his craft, and it's an honor. Let's premiere this Sex Mob song, and I'll be back next week. Until next time, I wish you all peace.
WVKR FM Poughkeepsie or online at WVKR.org.
Listener supported independent